You're listening to the Flasco Oncopod, brought to you by the Florida Society of Clinical Oncology, the voice of oncology in Florida.
Hi, welcome to the Flasco Oncopod. I'm Rami Kumrukji. I'm a vice chair of Malignant Hematology Department at the Moffitt Cancer Center. My research interests are myeloid diseases, mostly MDS, AML, and myeloproliferative neoplasms. We are here today to discuss updates in myelodysplastic syndromes, where we really recently had made progress in understanding the disease, revised the classification, the risk stratification, and most importantly, have new treatment options to offer for our patients. So as the audience will know, myelodysplastic syndromes are a heterogeneous group of myeloid neoplasms characterized by bone marrow failure, a tendency to progress to acute myeloid leukemia, but not every patient will progress. One-third of the patients eventually will progress. However, unfortunately, many of the patients will die from direct complications of the disease, namely the cytopenias and their complications. And it's important to stress that myelodysplastic syndromes are probably the most common myeloid neoplasm we deal with, where we roughly estimate 40 to 50,000 cases per year. In Florida, I think MDS is more prevalent given the older population we deal with. The average age for MDS diagnosis is in the early 70s. Really the landscape of the disease, the understanding of disease has evolved over the past few years. So first, we nowadays talk about precursor states before MDS. So there are a couple of entities, the CHIP and the CCUS, that we are starting to see patients, and probably you will encounter in your practice, even in patients with solid tumors. So as we know, all those diseases are really an interplay between somatic mutations, genetic events, clonality, and inflammatory milieus. And we know now by aging, we acquire somatic mutations in hematopoiesis. So we start developing what we call clonal hematopoiesis of indeterminate potential or aging. So CHIP is an entity where patients will develop a somatic mutation. Typically, those patients will not have any low blood counts. And they usually are found accidentally. If we sequence 100 people walking in the street above age of 70, 20% will have a CHIP mutation. The most common we encounter are the TET2, DNMT3A, and ASXL1, but any mutation can be seen, including the TP53, the JAK2, etc. Typically, you know, we see the variant allele frequency for those mutations in the magnitude of 10 to 20%, indicating that most of the hematopoiesis is still normal, but, you know, a subset of the cells are clonal. The importance of CHIP is that those patients can evolve into, you know, myeloid neoplasms with almost estimate risk of 0.5 to 1% per year. And there are now risk models that we use to kind of guesstimate that risks over the time for patients, which allows us to decide how often we are gonna follow those patients. What's important about this CHIP is not just the risk of developing myeloid neoplasms, but interestingly, the number one cause of mortality among those patients is accelerated atherosclerosis, cardiac events, and there had been correlation with many other diseases and comorbidities. There was also a recent fascinating paper just published last week in the New England Journal of Medicine showing, you know, that patients that have solid tumors, when they, you know, looked at the milieu or the niche around the solid tumors, those patients that have clonal hematopoiesis, if there were myeloid cells infiltrating the solid tumors, those patients had actually higher mortality, higher recurrence rate of solid tumors. The other thing that we're encountering often in practice, that those patients, you know, if they get chemotherapy for solid tumors that are at higher risk, 6 to 12 folds higher risk of developing myeloid neoplasms. So now we have clinics where we counsel those patients. If a patient is coming for adjuvant breast chemotherapy, for example, and the magnitude of benefit is limited and those patients have certain mutations, maybe they are better off served with hormonal therapy, for example. And we also see a lot of impact of those mutations in setting of modern therapies for lymphomas, myelomas like CAR Ts and bispecific, etc. After that, we have an entity called clonal cytopenia of unknown significance, where patients will have low blood counts, somatic mutations, but they don't have the clear dysplasia that's needed to call MDS. And those patients, are challenging because historically we could not get the drug approved for those patients. Recent studies, particularly if patients were classified as a higher risk CCUS, their outcome, depth cytopenia, is similar to MDS. So we are starting to treat more of those patients of the higher risk CCUS as MDS. Now, when it comes to MDS, obviously the diagnostic criteria require presence of cytopenia, dysplasia on the bone marrow, or increased myeloblast, or there are certain cytogenetic abnormalities that are diagnostic of MDS. And it's very important always to spend some time verifying the diagnosis for those patients, because there are things that can mimic MDS from other diseases like myeloid diseases to some nutritional deficiencies. B12 can cause megaloblastoid changes in the bone marrow. Classically, copper deficiency can cause ring sideroblast, and we've seen some patients labeled as MDS, treated as MDS, and all what they had copper deficiency. So it's very important to spend some time making sure that the diagnosis is established. Once we establish a diagnosis, we go into the classification. And the classifications have been revised recently, really to reflect more our understanding of the underlying biology of the infective hematopoiesis in those patients. A classification is really trying to lump more homogeneous group, because MDS is a clinical phenotype of a bone marrow failure. For in reality, what is several groups of diseases or stem cell neoplasms. So we have, now a WHO and ICC classification. There are differences and similarities, but I think the notion or the importance is now there are, classification based on molecular events. So we try to classify certain entities molecularly. So we have deletion 5q, we have SF3B1 MDS replacing MDS with ring sideroblast. We have the biallelic TP53. And the molecular classification precedes a morphologic classification. Those are very homogeneous group of, subgroups of the disease that have a unique biology molecular event that explains the ineffective hematopoiesis. And also it has some therapeutic implications, because as we will talk in a minute, that for example, patients deletion 5q has unique treatment darinazumab. Patients with SF3B1 have unique treatment upfront with luspatercept. Biallelic TP53 tend to do worse, unfortunately, and a very challenging group. And even some newer therapies may not benefit those patients. Also, the ICC introduces this idea if the myeloblasts are more than 10%, now we call MDS/AML, kind of in transition between the MDS/AML. It has some advantages in practice that sometimes we can borrow some of the drugs approved in AML, but it also have challenges, anxiety for the patients, and how do we assess responses, which trials those patients are gonna go on, so forth. But there is no doubt that the classification is a, refinement of the understanding of the biology. More importantly in practice is really the risk stratification. So we've used models to try to estimate the risk of the disease and the impact on patient survival. And we used to use International Prognostic Scoring System, or what we refer to as the IPSS. Then we had a revised format of it, and now we have a molecular-based IPSS. The idea, we look at cytopenias, their depth, percentage of the blast, cytogenetics, and now we incorporate the molecular data, and we stratify patients into really two major groups, a higher risk or a lower risk group. A higher risk group, this is life-threatening disease. Those are the patients we are thinking of allogeneic stem cell transplant. And a lower risk group, where we go stepwise, historically, we try to alleviate cytopenias and namely treat anemia. So once we establish the diagnosis, we risk stratify the patients and we put them in those two buckets. So if we talk about lower risk MDS, they remain actually the majority of the patients. Almost 60%, even in the modern risk stratification, are considered lower risk. The hallmark of those patients is really anemia. 90% of the patients are anemic, and over time 50% will become transfusion dependency. We know that anemia and transfusion dependency are associated with worse outcome. Once a patient becomes transfusion dependent, no matter what, those patients' survival is actually impacted by the fact that they are transfusion dependent, reflecting the underlying biology. And the heavier is the transfusion dependency, the worse the outcome for those patients. And that sets our goals in management in a way. And when we look at the natural history for those patients with lower risk, yes, a percentage of those patients, up to 30%, may progress to acute myeloid leukemia, which is life-threatening. But the majority, 70%, actually will stay in the lower risk state and unfortunately will die from complications either related directly to the cytopenia or the interplay of those cytopenias with other morbidities that the patients have, such as coronary artery disease. So we are paying more attention to that. And there also may be something behind even just the cytopenias, that the clonal hematopoiesis contributes to atherosclerosis and mortality among those patients. So in majority of the lower risk MDS, when we are treating, we are really treating anemia. And historically, all the drug approval strategies has been based on treating patients once they become red blood cell transfusion dependent, and the goal of the treatment is to render them transfusion independent. But in practice, many times we have patients that are symptomatic with the anemia that we end starting treatment earlier, and the field is really starting to move more toward treating patients when they are anemic symptomatic before they become transfusion dependent. But historically, all the drug approvals have been in that setting. And it's been exciting a couple of years for our patients that we have now more options to offer. The landscape had changed. We have two drugs that are approved in the lower risk MDS. So once we diagnose patients with lower risk MDS, the first question we ask, what's the predominant cytopenia? Is it anemia? Rarely we would see isolated thrombocytopenia or neutropenia as the main cytopenia that we have to treat in lower risk. So namely, it's focused on anemia. The presence of thrombocytopenia or neutropenia concomitantly could dictate our choice of treatment. But it's really mostly what we are talking about is treating anemia. And, for anemia, like obviously the first question we ask, do those patients have deletion 5q? And for that, we've had the standard of care of lenalidomide over many years, based on prior trials that led to the approval, and it remains our standard of care for patients with deletion 5q. There had been some recent trials trying to look at moving len earlier before patients are transfusion dependent, giving lower dose fixed duration. There are some evidence also coming sometimes when patients discontinue because of toxicity or preference, that sometimes we can gain the response back as long as those patients did not progress to a higher risk. So lenalidomide remains our standard of care for patients with deletion 5q. Then the next question becomes, do patients have ring sideroblasts or what we call MDS-SF3B1? And for those patients now, the upfront therapy had moved to become luspatercept. Luspatercept is a fusion trap protein. Neutralizes TGF-beta ligands that regulate terminal erythroid differentiation, so it releases that block. Originally, we developed those drugs in patients after ESA failure in patients with ring sideroblast. There was a trial called the MEDALIST that led to the approval. And then we conducted a trial called the COMMANDS, where we took patients with lower risk MDS, transfusion dependent, whether they are RS positive or RS negative, and randomized them between erythroid-stimulating agents and luspatercept, looking at transfusion independency for 12 weeks and a hemoglobin increase of 1.5. And indeed, luspatercept, outperformed ESAs, namely when you look at the subset of patients with ring sideroblast positive, doubling the erythroid responses and doubling the duration. The guidelines have moved to use luspatercept upfront in RS positive. It's also a choice in patients with RS negative, maybe because of a little bit more durable responses. Some of the shortcomings of the luspatercept are really that in patients with high endogenous serum EPO level more than 500 or being heavily transfusion dependent, the response rates are low and the transfusion independency is rare. Luspatercept is given as subcutaneous injection once every 3 weeks. We start at a dose of 1, we go up to 1.33 and then up to 1.75. And it's really exciting to see a new treatment for the upfront therapy. Now, at the time of failure of either ESA or luspatercept, historically we did not have many options. Hypomethylating agents were used commonly in practice. Those agents probably have somewhere around 20 to 30% hematological improvement or transfusion independency. But we do also see this post-HMA failure and poor outcomes. So we tend to reserve the use of hypomethylating agents in as a last resort, or in cases where there are concomitant neutropenia or thrombocytopenia. The next exciting drug that really got approved in MDS last year, based on also a randomized phase 3 clinical trial, is imetelstat. Imetelstat is a telomerase inhibitor. It takes advantage that the telomerase activity is increased in MDS and telomere length is shortened. So it's almost like the principle of synthetic lethality further inhibiting those cells. And the trials originally, were conducted in a phase 1, phase 2, and led to a trial called the EMERGE trial. The EMERGE trial looked at patients that were lower risk MDS, ESA failure, transfusion dependent, and in fact, the trial required high transfusion dependency, more than 4 units of blood. And patients were randomized between imetelstat, which is given as once a month IV infusion, outpatient, versus placebo. And indeed, the trial met the primary endpoint, showing around almost 40% of the patients became transfusion independent for 8 weeks or more. The median duration was almost around 52 weeks. The hemoglobin increase was around 3.4 median gram per deciliter, which is probably next to lenalidomide in terms of robust response. The responses were seen in all subsets, whether they were RS positive or RS negative, higher or lower transfusion burden, EPO level above 500 or less than 500. And when we look more in the data, there are a subset of patients that almost, had more than 1 year transfusion independency, and those patients, the median duration will extend beyond 2 years. And there is also some correlative studies performed on those study in the EMERGE study suggest that it could have a disease-altering features. There were some cytogenetic responses seen. There were reductions in the allele burden of mutations that actually correlated with the transfusion independency. So really a robust activity that led to the approval of the drug by the FDA. The side effects are really myelosuppression predominantly. That's the major toxicity observed. There is grade 3 or 4 thrombocytopenia and neutropenia in almost half of the patients, seen mostly during the first 2 cycles that would require dose holding, dose reduction. But the clinical events, whether they were febrile neutropenia, less than 1%, or clinical bleeding were rare to encounter. So it's mostly really neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, grade 3 and 4, but luckily did not translate to many relevant clinical adverse events for the patients. So now imetelstat is approved by the FDA and available. The NCCN guidelines place imetelstat as a second-line option in patients after ESA failure or luspatercept failure, as long as they have adequate platelets and neutrophils. And also the NCCN guidelines actually list imetelstat as potential first-line option in patients with endogenous serum EPO level above 500, or those patients with high transfusion burden. So that had been really exciting, development, now having luspatercept available upfront and imetelstat as an option for our patients. There are several other drugs in development. We have a drug called elritercept, similar to luspatercept. This is an activin A fusion trap protein for the activin A ligands. In the initial studies, phase 1-2 had shown promising activity, trilineage responses both in RS positive, RS negative. Responses in high transfusion dependent patients. So now it's moving in a clinical trial called the RENEW, looking at patients after ESA failure randomized between placebo and elritercept. And there are many trials going targeting the inflammatory milieu and lower risk MDS, pathways such as NLRP, inflammasome pathway, IRAK1, IRAK4 pathway, a hepcidin antagonist or hepcidin pathway. So those all are earlier studies. But definitely the landscape for lower risk MDS is changing. We are moving to earlier treatment. There is an ongoing study called The Element that's trying to look at use of ESA and luspatercept before transfusion dependency and trying to look at the outcome for those patients. Similarly, also we are exploring use of imetelstat in clinical trials, further moving it earlier or in combinations as well. Now, when it comes to the higher risk MDS, allogeneic stem cell transplant remains our only curative option for those patients. So we really should consider allogeneic stem cell transplant earlier on. The maximum gain of survival is to move to transplant earlier. And if we use modern risk stratification like the IPSS-M, if we are upstaging patients, it's reasonable to consider transplant earlier on for those patients. If they are not candidate for transplant, then we still treat them stepwise. The backbone of treatment for the higher risk remains hypomethylating agents, azacitidine or decitabine, and now we have oral decitabine, cedazuridine approved as an oral option for the patients. For patients going to transplant, there is a lot of controversy on the impact of therapy before transplant. I think the most important message is basically a lack of response should not preclude patients not going to transplant because it remains the only curative option. And transplant remains our only cure for those patients. A subset of patients that have the p53 mutation, this is very challenging. Whether we transplant those patients or not is really controversial. There is still 20% cure rate, so people will argue that we cannot offer cure other than transplant, so we should offer it. Others argue that if the recurrence rates are very high, 80%, maybe those patients' benefit is not worth going through the complications of the transplant. I think the decision should be individualized. If we have patients with p53, we treat them. We hope that we clear the mutation, get them to transplant, get them on maintenance strategies. And it's really an individualized decision with the patient whether they want to proceed to transplant or not. Patients that are not going to transplant, obviously, hypomethylating agents remain our standard of care. What we expect with those agents, somewhere roughly around 20% complete responses, around a year and a half median overall survival. We are all awaiting in MDS a randomized clinical trial called the Verona, where patients are randomized between azacitidine, venetoclax. As well known, venetoclax had become standard in AML. We are trying to move that to MDS. In MDS, the dosing is only 2 weeks, but there had been phase one, phase two data promising, looking at potentially doubling the complete response rates. And we are eagerly awaiting the Verona study results. In practice, sometimes we do use venetoclax in patients with a very high blast percentage approaching AML for patients going for transplant because several data sets, including ours, have shown that those patients that received HMA ven-based therapy proceeded to transplant had a 2-year survival approaching 80 or 90% compared to historically 50 or 60%. Certain patients that have certain mutations like ASXL1, it seems that the addition of venetoclax may overcome that. However, again, the final decision will be really based on the phase 3 randomized Verona study. Patients with TP53, unfortunately, in AML setting and MDS don't seem to drive survival advantage from addition of venetoclax. Maybe higher response rates a little bit, but no survival advantage. And unfortunately, in the higher risk MDS, we had several trials that had failed to show improvement with several novel agents added to the backbone of hypomethylating agents. Now, at time of HMA failure among higher risk MDS, I think one of the most important things is to assess the disease again and look for molecular targets. Collectively, nowadays, one-third of the patients will have an abnormality that we could target. So, for example, maybe up to 10% of the patients will have an IDH1, IDH2 mutation where we have therapies, maybe have NPM1. Sometimes we see emergence of FLT3. So it's very important to assess the disease. And recently also we got approval for ivosidenib, which is an IDH1 inhibitor in patients with relapsed refractory MDS. Historically, post-HMA failure, the survival is 4 to 6 months. Among patients that have IDH1 mutation treated with ivosidenib, the survival was 36 months. There is another IDH1 inhibitor called olutasidenib that also had similar data in MDS, showing, improvement in the survival among those patients. So whenever there is a targeted therapy, we really urge to, look for those and treat patients with those options. So overall, really exciting time in MDS, a lot of trials going, including phase three trials ongoing, new drugs approved, namely luspatercept in lower risk MDS and entelestat with a novel mechanism of action, potential disease modification. And we hope that the Verona study will also be positive to incorporate use of venetoclax in higher risk MDS. Hopefully, all of this will translate to better care for our patients and be readily available in your practice to use. Thank you very much for listening.